Welcome to Change Agents, the podcast series looking at grassroots actions and solutions from the inside out. Real people making real changes in communities of color and others right where they live and work. Stories about folks transforming their neighborhoods and the narratives about them.
I'm Change Agents producer Jeb Bakke with On the Way Home. I'm here cooking with Sean in a community kitchen and cafe that was largely created because of her.
Not too much. I just sprinkle until my ancestors say, enough, child.
Here in Greater Grand Crossing on the south side of Chicago, a cafe space may not seem like a big deal. After all, there's a Dunkin' Donuts just around the corner. But there's a lot more beneath the surface of these shiny tabletops and cozy nooks. This cafe is located in the Light Collective Drop-In Center for Homeless Youth. That's L-Y-T-E. And it's free for anyone to come in and use at any time. But before we get too ahead of ourselves, I want to introduce you to our chef.
My name is Sean Hinkle. I mean, I don't really have like a specific title, but I'll say I'm like a youth staff, youth advocate here at the Light Collective, specifically working on building the food and nutrition program here.
Sean made a strong push for this cafe to be built when they first began constructing the drop-in center. Her passion for food not only comes from her professional background, but also from a deeply rooted connection developed over the course of her personal history. And this cafe is inspired by the book of her life.
All the stuff, like a series of books.
Right. Like the series of books that has been Sean's life so far. Because much of what the youth entering the building are experiencing, Sean has known firsthand.
For the most part, like, I have experienced pretty much whatever you can think of in that sector as far as homelessness, unstable housing, endangered housing, couch surfing. You know, I've had to stay with people I didn't exactly want to stay with. I've rode the train all night because I had nowhere to go. There were even other circumstances where we would have like overnight shelters, which is basically shelters you stay overnight and you had to get up and go, take everything with you. There's not guarantee you're gonna have a bed. And so in those moments, those are the times where it's like, okay, where do I go? And it's like, I don't want to go to this library again because that's where everybody else is. So let's hang out at Starbucks because I feel like if I go there for 1 second, it will kind of take me away from what it is that I'm going through because it'll make me feel like I'm a part of the community because that's what regular people do. I didn't feel regular because of what I was going through. And I wanted to feel regular because I didn't want to think about what I was going through. And for me, going to like spaces like that would help me with that.
This cafe provides a space of normalcy and safety that Sean craved all those years ago. But this sense of comfort and support is not easily found for the homeless youth of Chicago. And Sean knows what it's like to go through the world without a safety net.
Even as a young kid, like, you know, you come from the inner city, you know, you don't really have access to the same opportunities that other people have. So just lack of resources, lack of opportunities, growing up in scarcity. Like, I grew up in probably one of the poorest neighborhoods in Chicago, like on the west side.
Which neighborhood?
East Garfield Park. Mm. Then, you know, I moved around a lot. It's weird. As a child, I didn't know that we were, I guess, quote unquote, I don't like saying it, poor. I was pretty much just born into like a broken home. My parents had divorced when I was really young. Well, separated technically.
Sean bounced around a lot between parents and other family members living in unstable conditions. Sean pushed through it all, continuing with her work in school. But midway through high school,
I was trying to overcome another adversity. Like, I lost my dad my sophomore year, and I knew how important it was for him, for me to finish school. And so that's kind of what drove me. I was like, okay, I got to do this, like, for real, for real.
Sean did finish high school and had plans to go to college.
I applied to 7, and I did get accepted to 5 of them. And I picked the one I wanted to go. I was like, I'm going to Carbondale. That was the plan I had. You know, I was like, okay, because this is what you do. You go to high school, you finish high school, you go to college.
Shawn doesn't really like to speak in too much detail on this part of her life, but she did not end up going to Carbondale.
The thing is, when you are a teenager, you don't really have any say-so in anything. You have to get consent from a parent, and it's like, okay, the one that I know is going to give me consent is no longer here, so what do I do? And at that point, it's like, okay, I couldn't do anything.
Consent for?
For, like, leaving, going to school.
So Shawn continued to live with family after high school. But a different struggle became hard to bear. A struggle between who Shawn is and what her family wanted her to be.
I really don't label myself, but, you know, I am, like, a part of, like, the LGBTQ community.
And as Shawn began to know herself better, she found that her homes were refusing to accept her as she is. As a result, her self-worth plummeted.
Not accepting myself, not knowing who I was, because I was so clouded with the distractions of everything that was going on around me. Like, in the beginning, it was like, I'm not talking to anybody about this because they're going to look at me like something's wrong with me. And that was a point where I did attempt to do it, and it just, it was not, like, it didn't go well.
Any effort to speak about her identity was met with criticism and rejection. Shawn doesn't like to speak in too much detail about this either. My impression is that there's still a lot of pain in this history that feels a bit too close to touch. Suffice to say, the difficulty Shawn faced for wanting to be herself was becoming too much.
What I do remember is just feeling completely out of place, feeling isolated, just feeling kind of just torn. And that was when I knew, like, I had to escape. I had to get out of here. But having to go through that process of bouncing and moving from place to place to place, that was something that I didn't expect to have to experience, because I looked at it as such a simple thing. Like, hey, I just want to be free, be me. Yeah, I had no choice. If I wanted to become better and have a better life and kind of change the environment that I was in, it would be like that.
Like so many people in Chicago, Shawn had no support systems in place to help her attain the basic necessities of a home and food. With lacking help from friends, family, and community, Shawn would have to rely on the homeless support programs and nonprofits. But navigating these systems is no easy task. Not to mention, the bureaucracy and unfeeling policies often bring out whole other traumas. To get a greater sense of homeless support systems in Chicago, I sat down with someone who knows a lot more about this than me.
My name is Carl Wiley, and I am the Chief Creative Officer for the Light Collective.
Carl has worked in the homeless service sector for over a decade, and he's seen a lot of angles of the help homeless youth are provided with. From government-funded programs like the COC or Continuums of Care to organizations that stray from government funding.
So I've seen both sides. I've had a chance to, like, be a manager at the COC and see how the funding operates. I've also had an opportunity to be higher up in Light Collective and be outside the system.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, is the main force behind most government support for homeless youth. The COC is one program among a multitude that HUD provides, which by all accounts is a good thing. Government support for folks experiencing homelessness is a key factor in providing somewhat consistent funding and support so that folks aren't relying upon programs that can lose donors or outside financial support. But these government programs are flawed. Their main issues lie in how they are implemented and who they apply to. But before we get into any of that, let's get down to basics. Among the countless types of care, the obvious first support to provide to folks without homes is a home. Let's look into what that government housing program looks like.
So it's called the One List. And basically, there is a governing body that oversees that list. And so everyone who calls, you get placed on that wait list. Then they have a matching department that matches you based on your need.
That means you'll get different types of housing based on factors like how many kids you have, your employment, and your health condition. When Carl and I initially talked facts and figures, getting matched with housing looked a little something like this.
I believe it was averaging, like, at the soonest it would be matched was 290 days.
A grueling amount of time to be without a home. However, the data providing that figure has been taken down for some time. It was my hope that perhaps the process had improved. Thanks to the help of Carl's internet sleuthing, More up-to-date statistics have come to the surface. Here's a follow-up from Carl.
They have published a report that includes some of this new data. It's in their new report called Data Highlights from Chicago's Homeless Service System Q1 and Q2. But in that report, they mentioned that the average number of days it takes to get connected to housing was around 1,500 days. I was shocked.
Though once the shock wore off for Carl, things did start to add up a bit more.
It is more reflective, I think, of my experience in supporting people, but it's just sort of shocking to see that that's the average number of days, meaning that there's a proportion of people that it's taking longer than 1,500 days to get housing support through the city of Chicago.
It's one of those times that first learning new information can feel so terrible, but once settled into the reality of the situation, it kind of makes it all make sense. Carl has seen people struggle for an unrelenting amount of time. Think about it. 1,500 days. That's over 4 years.
And that doesn't mean you have keys in hand at that point. That means you're matched with a housing outcome. So like you're a single adult or you're a single, you know, youth head of household and you've been matched with this Rapid Rehousing program. You've been matched, but you haven't been given keys. You haven't been told what program you're in. So there's still more time there. So it can be a really long time. And I think that's why for people who are listening, that's why a lot of folks can be on the train with their luggage. That's why you'll see a lot of people that are out in public because these lists can take an extremely long time, even when they work.
And there's a reason why Carl says, even when they work. That's because most of the time, they don't.
The first hardest part is just the fact that sometimes you'll just get completely lost in that system. A lot of the time, my job is following up and contacting the people that I know that are overseeing this list and saying, hey, what's going on with so-and-so? Hey, why has their case not moved? You know, it's been several weeks and they haven't heard anything back. So that has been sort of a problem, is just the constantly maintaining and pushing that through. Another, I think, issue that youth are falling into with the one list is the fact that, particular to youth, they have to constantly call to stay on the list. So it's considered an active list, whereas, you know, in the past, if you got your name on your list, it might be a year or two, but they'll eventually call you. Now, if you get your name on the list, you have to call every month and say, I still need housing. And if you don't call back and say, I still need housing, they take you off the list. It puts kind of another hurdle in place for youth. If you have an unstable phone connection, if there's a lot happening in your life or you forget to call, you can fall off that list.
So even if we presume that someone will get housing on the one list, what do they do in the meantime? Aren't there housing shelters?
The shelter system, it's pretty tough for young adults and the youth that we serve. It's a lot of times the shelters are mostly catering towards older adults. And so if you're a young person, if you're, you know, 24 or 25, you may feel uncomfortable in some of those spaces. I've heard a lot of youth reporting that it's just tough to be in there. There are some youth overnight shelters, which are great. They're more catered towards young people. They're much more fitting what the youth are needing at the time.
But those are few and far between. So for the rest?
The majority of young people that I've supported over the years tend to just not engage with the shelter system at all. When you look at the data, the vast majority of youth that are housing unstable are sleeping on couches, and they're bouncing from couch to couch, from friend's house to friend's house.
This makes sense. It's definitely so much more comfortable to stay on a friend's couch rather than sleeping in an uncomfortable shelter. But here's the thing.
And that's typically not counted as experiencing homelessness by the HUD definition.
The majority of youth experiencing homelessness are not counted and not provided with support. And that's just one of the barriers. There are also age cutoffs for who can receive youth-specific support. These restrictions can pile on top of the difficulties a young person would already be facing.
When I was working at a housing program on the north side, and it was a large international agency that also had this youth transitional housing program for people who were 18 to, it was 18 to 21 was the demographic for this housing program. And there was a young man who was working on an immigration case. He was here on actually asylum. He'd fled violence in a different country. He was staying in this youth international program as part of this large organization, but he turned 18 in that program. And because of the limitations of that program, he had no stable place to go, and he had turned 18. He was considered by the system to be a homeless adult. And so then he got moved. He was no longer able to go into those youth programs.
Which led to him being transferred to where Carl was working, where the age cutoffs were a little bit higher.
He showed up on his 18th birthday. The caseworker brought a cake with him, and he was emotionally distraught. And
It was where this like arbitrary number that said, now you're 18, you cannot be in this youth program, you have to be in this sort of older adult program, that really had a huge impact on this young person.
Imagine. Your 18th birthday comes, and that morning you're forced to leave the very place that was supposed to support you. Young people who are in dire need of help are knocked around between establishments because of arbitrary limits of age. They aren't allowed to receive support because of unrealistic definitions of homelessness. Not to mention, this system is riddled with flaws where young people fall through the gaps, and these are just a few pieces of the puzzle. So what do we do? It's obvious that the systems in place aren't doing everything we need from them. Should we rely on organizations that work outside of government funding? What happens when they lack consistent finances, or they aren't able to pay a high enough wage to adequately support their staff? It also brings into question, why are so many people living without homes in the first place? The data is clear. There is enough vacant housing to provide a home to every person in need. But for some, the solution to homelessness isn't that simple. Land ownership, economic concerns, and larger moralizing arguments are made. But on the flip side, in a scenario where the U.S. moves forward with a solution of blanket housing support, the tax dollars spent providing homes could offset the amount that would have been spent on things like healthcare and law enforcement systems. To move beyond the entanglements of the economy and work ethic philosophies, let's consider the core of the issue. Is housing a human right? Settling into the reality of our current situation, no one is guaranteed the right to housing, and no one is even guaranteed a good shot at getting it. So what do we do to help today? After all, this is the world that we live in, and we can make a difference for people here and now. Let's return to the building where I've been cooking with Sean and speak to Dr. Casey Holtschneider, who founded the support center. Similar to Carl, Dr. Holtschneider has seen the many faces of the homeless service systems. Well aware that homelessness can't only be solved by the work of nonprofits, Dr. Holtschneider focuses her aim toward harm reduction. But she's also seen the ways where in many instances where people are housed, in some regards, they're destined to struggle again.
These are systemic and structural issues. The fact that you could work 3 part-time jobs and still not have health insurance or be able to afford your rent, that's a structural issue. You're not failing because that's happening.
In 2016, Dr. Holtschneider researched the long-term turnout of folks who had been assisted into housing. The research revolved around interviews with folks that she had worked with directly about 5-10 years prior. Here's Dr. Holtschneider.
That was a very deep moment for me in the study when I had young people start to tell me that, you know, they had left the program and things were pretty good. They had all the sports around them, but then it was like, okay, you turned 21. Bye. And then they hit crisis again. And I would say to them, like, why didn't you call me? And I heard from young people saying, I felt ashamed that I felt that I had screwed up because I had left and things were good. I had the independence, and I felt like I had failed.
Inspired by these stories, Dr. Holtschneider set out to create lasting support. Her approach applies what she calls accompaniment, in which folks are never simply left to their own devices, but rather continuously connected to a network of support. For years and years after they leave direct care, individuals are checked in on. The Light Collective, now with a physical drop-in center, gives comprehensive connections beyond housing support, be it healthcare, lawyers, childcare, you name it. Moreover, Light believes in additional support beyond people's material needs. They intend to invest deeply into the folks that they serve.
You have drop-in centers, right? That's not a new program model for homelessness services. That's sort of all over. Once you go in, it's sort of you line up for this thing, which is like the food line or for the shower line or the laundry line. And all of that was like just really incredibly demoralizing for a lot of people and didn't have a lot of dignity and humanity in it.
Dr. Holtschneider found that while, of course, having food and shelter are necessities for people,
it still kind of knocks me on my feet when I think about it.
When she asked young people what the most important parts of homeless service systems were,
it was these other parts of the services that saw them as whole human beings and fueled their souls. And part of what I took from that was young people really saying that this was about other people investing in them as whole human beings. And that also those were things that helped give them the strength to get through the struggle that they were going through.
Light provides opportunities to make music, write poetry, create art, go on camping trips. Experiences where folks are valued and valuing themselves for more than the difficulty they're experiencing. Sean was once a person in dire need of a space like this, where she could value herself and be valued. Now, Sean is significantly more secure than she was when she was younger.
I feel like we're constantly having to discover a variety of aspects of ourselves every single day, as long as we're here. And so I feel like now that I am in a better space, that is definitely something that I can do more versus back then. Because I feel like the environment and everything that I was experiencing did contribute to me not being able to do that as much as I can now. Like now I can actually like sit and just kind of think and sit with myself and just really figure out like, who am I? Like, what are these parts of me specifically?
And Sean's not alone in that feeling. What Sean is describing is the very real mental shift that social workers like Carl and Casey fight to provide. Our brains tend to have a harder time self-actualizing when in a constant state of fending for ourselves. So in the name of self-actualizing, I asked Sean the following question.
I also can't help but notice that you note yourself as a member of the LGBTQ community, but you haven't necessarily said if there's anything in particular that you identify with. And I don't want you to feel pressure, but just wanted to leave you space if you want to clarify what your journey's been with that.
No, yeah, absolutely. So that really is kind of why I was like, I don't feel like I have a specific label, because my thing is I don't believe in boxes. Like, I'm not into boxes.
And with this newer, more secure stage in Sean's life, she won't have to conform to boxes anymore. Relating it back to her culinary knowledge.
You know, people are a believer in quality over quantity. But at the same time, if you don't have access to certain things, it's kind of going to be more quantity. Like, what can I have that's going to last me? And we're going to constantly be in that survivor mode. But when we have like the options like to go shop and get like fresh fruits and vegetables and eat, you know, more seasonally, then that's kind of like the mindset would change for people.
Sean knows how much a change in environment can affect your life, be it toward food, self-acceptance, or health.
Basically, it's saying like the more you take care of yourself, the more you're protecting yourself. So I definitely feel like that's how I know that I'm really putting more into me, just literally just by being more mindful of what I consume. And not just like food, but even like the music I listen to, the shows I watch, like just the environment I'm in. Going back to what I had to experience throughout my whole life is having that insight of, okay, I don't want to be in this environment because it does take a toll on all those different assets. So even kind of taking yourself out of certain environments, that's another part of it. But just being mindful of what you consume, being mindful of what you do, just making your body feel good, that's how you'll know for sure. It's just what I'm doing to better myself.
From the meals she makes to the love she can now give herself, Sean's life can finally flourish the way she wanted it to all those years ago when she left home. And if things get hard again, she'll know that people like Carl and Casey will have her back, as she will theirs.
This has been On the Way Home. My name is Jeb Bakke.
Thank you for joining Change Agents, the podcast series looking at grassroots actions and solutions from the inside out. Produced by Juneteenth Productions. Theme music composed by Sarah Abdallah. Funding support provided by the Chicago Community Trust, the Field Foundation, and DePaul University's Center for Communication Engagement. Subscribe to this series on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you find podcasts. Follow Change Agents on Facebook, Instagram,